Okay, on the show today, we've got Samantha Skyring, who's the CEO and founder of Oryx Desert Salt. And we're going to be speaking about success and setbacks and differentiation, latest trends, and a whole bunch of questions that we have for her just to understand her journey. So many things to ask you, because I'm really passionate about your product and I'm passionate about your journey and very excited about being able to speak to you today. So
thank you for inviting me.
You're
so
welcome.
Wonderful to have you here.
Yay. So just a couple of questions. So I want to ask you questions that I think our viewers would want to ask you, and specifically everybody out there who's ever wanted to be an entrepreneur. They look at your product. I mean, you're everywhere now. You're in Pick n Pay, you're in Woolworths, you're in the UK, you're like global. And so it's like, as an ordinary consumer, you pick up the product and you think, who's behind this brand and how did it get here? So how did you start your entrepreneurial journey? How did you pick salt as a product? I mean, like, to go from the big, you know, humble beginnings to like these amazing premises, just maybe tell me that.
I'll do that. So I think salt came to me. A friend was exporting it to Germany, and he didn't want to do the South African market. And I had been using it and wanted to share it with my friends because it's so beautiful. It's such an unrefined salt from a very special, beautiful place in a very remote salt pan up in the Kalahari Desert. So I thought, okay, well, I'll take the South African market. So in the beginning, I saw it on every restaurant table. So I kind of had the vision quite quickly of it being available and being on restaurant tables. That was the one aspect that I followed up on from the beginning. But I think the entrepreneurial journey has actually been part of who I am from a very, very young age. 13, I started working. Actually, my parents had a financial crash and lost their business. And so that actually just gave me the impetus of just get out and go do it. And in fact, up until 5 years ago, I hadn't been salaried for 17 years.
Wow.
So I've gone from various projects and various businesses. And
have you experienced failure before? Had you like had this amazing dream and like lost it all? I mean, like,
I
did
have.
You always have all these successful businesses behind you? Like,
no. So the one was an amazing business that was in tourism, and unfortunately, I had partners who decided they wanted it all. And they managed to use the legal kind of scenario to get us out. It was quite devastating. I was 22. I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to be strong. In fact, what was very interesting for me was I didn't have the conviction to say, this is what I want. And what's interesting is, so I did Oryx Salt for a year, and then I got my first business partner in. And we had a year's journey together, and we still weren't profitable after that second year, which I wasn't actually expecting. I mean, I had the 1,000 days in mind, but he didn't come to me and sit me down and say, I'm feeling concerned. I got a lawyer's letter, which was a bit of a shock and out of the blue, but that was the way only way he could deal with it. But what was interesting was 22 years later, I was like, no, actually, I'm doing this.
Oh, wow.
So that gave me the conviction. So I suddenly felt this courage and this conviction in the fire to go,
so if you hadn't
I'm doing this.
If you hadn't been screwed over
in a way,
maybe you wouldn't have had the lesson and the learning and the courage and the know-how.
To stand up
for yourself. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know,
interesting.
For many years, I've always looked at, you know, my failures and my hardships and my struggles and my trials as like shame, but it's only recently, because as I've become older and wiser, that I've realized they were lessons. They were lessons. I worked with that horrible cow, you know who you are, I worked with that horrible cow because she had to teach me, because I had so many rough edges that needed wearing off, and I was partnered with this terrible person because I had to learn how to grow a spine and a pear. You know,
absolutely, it's
so
true.
That's exciting. Okay, so how did you So, okay, so let me just see now.
I mean, I can speak more on that if you want me to a little bit. Yeah. So the other, for me, power and passion has actually come, there are three things that I put it down to. One is being over 40, love being over 40.
Totally. I can't wait to be over 40 one day. Okay, no, I'm over 40. It's true. No, being over 40 rocks.
Definitely. Yeah. And being a mum, having that responsibility and suddenly realizing I'm responsible for another human being. And being a single mum has been very powerful. Yeah. Not having a support and just needing to make it happen.
Wow.
And then also, in fact, when that first partner decided that he didn't want to be part of it, I realized, wow, you know, I've actually really only been working very hard for 2 years of my life. Yeah. And I was like, okay, but maybe I'm going to live to 84. That means I've got 42 years. I'm definitely giving my age away. 42 years left to live, and I want to live a beautiful standard of living, and I really want to live. And I was like, gee, that's a long time. I need to... It was the first time that it really sunk in that I've got to take care of myself for a long time, and how am I going to do that? How, what is my financial vehicle going to be? And so I really put the commitment in to Oryx and to say that this is my financial vehicle.
This is your investment.
This is my investment.
Yeah. Having a kid forces you to be responsible and not just like, oh, okay, fine.
Float around.
Because you have totally. To pay for school fees and you have to pay for
You've got these monthly university. Expenses and you kind of plan ahead a little bit more. I mean, I knew that I wanted him to go to a certain school and it was not negotiable. He was going to go to Waldorf school, actually, and mainstream wasn't an option for me. So I knew that I needed to make the money to be able to afford that.
And so in the very beginning, like, okay, so fine, someone came to you with a product, but how did you, like, what was the first things that you did? How did you get sales? How did you actually knock on doors and get people to stock your product? What have you done to...
Okay. So I...
Who was your first customer?
Okay. So I actually started packing the product on my dining room table.
Wow.
So it was literally had a tub.
A bag of salt.
A bag of salt. And poured it in and checked it and sifted through it to make sure there were no pieces and packed the cotton bags myself.
And you came up with the brand... Yourself? Where did the brand
come from? Oh, so the brand, in 2000 when I had no child and I had time and money, really? What was that? I did a very beautiful 5-month journey with friends to Namibia.
Okay.
And I ended up doing a 7-day walk through the Namib Desert, 120 kilometers. We hadn't ever got to the Skeleton Coast, so we decided to walk there.
Wow.
And I had close encounters with the Oryx.
Oh, wow.
And so they became a very powerful and special memory for me of that journey. And so when I was offered this product from the Kalahari, that was this beautiful image because they were standing 3 meters in front of me. This masked face and these tall horns was the imagery that came up.
Okay.
But it has actually changed. I knew nothing about packaging or... product or logos or anything, so it's really been a learning curve. And it felt like it took up too much space in the front. I felt like I needed to share that it was unrefined and unprocessed and from an ancient source and no additives and sun-dried, and so I had all that info and sustainable, and it had all of that information on the front of the bag. And we were gifted, actually, after my partners have been with me currently for 4 years, as just after we partnered, a mutual friend of ours said, I can do something with that brand. But the interesting thing was this logo was actually the very first little pencil diagram that I drew.
Oh, wow.
But I ended up changing it to a sort of a side view that took up less space on the packaging.
Okay.
So, but it felt like this was meant to be.
Yes.
I just needed strong partners in order to help me hold it
to
make it happen.
Lovely.
So it went through a little bit of a foundational period, and then came into its own.
Yes. So you're on the dining room table and you're packing it, the product yourself.
And I hit the road. I was... I just started knocking on doors. I mean, I had an interesting experience because I actually left an abusive relationship in Denmark, and so I came back with my little three-year-old, and I really just had to make it happen. And I was staying in a little wooden Wendy house, very, very small, and I didn't have much money either. And I remember this few days where I was, I think I was having panic attacks. I was battling to breathe. Didn't have much money. I had no air time. I had no petrol. And there was one restaurant, actually, that I had visited a few times.
Yeah.
And they phoned me up, and they were like, Raf, you want 24 grinders of each. Yay. It was about 575 rand. And it just, I was like, I can do this. This can work. So that was my first restaurant, and my first retail was a beautiful shop in Komiki on the main road called Rogers Fruiterers, and a lovely Asian lady by the name of Merle. And having traveled in India, I love, you know, when you go to a shop, if you're the first customer in the morning, you are their blessing for the day.
Yeah.
And Merle just felt like my blessing. She gave me a couple of names of why didn't you go here and there, and so the product, it actually went on consignment, which wasn't a good idea. Learned in retrospect, consignment does not work.
So now you get them to buy it from you?
Yes. Yeah.
Why does consignment not work? Because I know a lot of startup retailers, you know, people in the retail space, startup entrepreneurs, they consignment's the only thing they know.
I mean, I guess it does get the product out on shelf. And my thought was, I'd rather it to be sitting on a shop shelf having views. Sales and getting views rather than sitting in my warehouse. But when a shop doesn't take ownership of a product because they haven't paid for it, there's something that just they don't value it as much.
It's
they
the
don't
energy.
Yeah, it's
I understand.
And yet I was coming from a place of I need you. So if you're going to put it on your shelf, then but the recon of it just always ends up being a mess.
So when did you have the confidence to switch to no, you must buy it?
Probably a couple of years down the line.
So you did on consignment for a couple of years, and then you switched to no, actually buy it up front. And did you find that people said no because they did you find people said yes because they knew you, and that people said no because they didn't know you, if they didn't know you, so like a new prospective client, would they say no to that? Or was it sort of a confidence thing that you felt that now you
I had been burned. In fact, I am a rep decided to go on his own and become a distributor, and so he took a hold of stock and he was giving it out as consignment, and then he didn't pay me. So it was like, okay, that was really the final.
Like, and it's not like a services industry where, okay, fine, it's just hours, and at the end of the day, okay, fine, it's salaries, but you know, you've got hard costs in each product.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I guess it does work for that initial period, but there's a point where there is that value. Like, I value my product. If you want the product, then let's do that exchange. It is going to sell.
Okay.
Just something that does change along the way, I think.
Your confidence. Confidence in yourself and in your product.
And also realizing the cash flow and having limited time, so to have to follow up on those people to make those little payments of stock that has sold just ends up being time consuming and a bit stressful, like
product,
running after.
Your cash is tied up in consignment stock as opposed to stock that's actually shifted. And how did you get into the big retailers? Because I think a lot of smaller entrepreneurs are very intimidated calling up a Woolworths or a Pick and Pay. Like, what was your journey there? And also, I've heard some horror stories of some of the bigger retailers. They're quite hard on their suppliers, especially their small guys. You can easily, like, I think, lose your shirt.
There have been those stories. I think I've had a very beautiful and a very graceful journey, actually, into retail. My strategy was to stay in the speciality, in the smaller deli and butcher shops and so on, pastelikis, in order to get the brand out. And I think that was very important, together with the restaurants. If I'd gone directly onto retail shelf, I wouldn't have moved. Whereas now, after it took us 5 years to go into retail.
So you first built up the brand nationally through small retailers.
Independence.
Okay, so that when you went on shelves, there was already some recognition. So there was recognition coming from people eating at restaurants and seeing your product on the tables. And then when you went into national, So would your advice be to do the same thing or to push for national? I mean, if you could do things differently now, do you think that?
I don't think I would do it differently. Hmm. I mean, the retail, also, I can't, I would never have been able to do 5 years ago what I do now. Like the managing capacity of the product. Retail is hard, there's a lot of admin around it, you know, being on the EDI and the portal. And a business is a bit like a child. Mm-hmm. So if you're given a 7-year-old or 11-year-old who's got all their idiosyncrasies and their habits and their likes and their dislikes, you know, you don't know that. So, you know, with a baby, you grow and you get to know them. So a business is like that.
So you first learned, you practiced on the smaller retailers. Mm. And
getting
your
systems,
operations, mm-hmm. your returns, your your stock control, all of that stuff in place, so that when you went to the bigger guys, you were already all. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, if one's starting in the industry that one doesn't know, to try and play big, doesn't. I'd imagine one can get one's fingers very, very burnt.
Could you survive on your business? At what point could you, like, earn a bit of a salary? Did it take you like 6 months before you could, like, how were you surviving? Because you literally were you desperate for money, so it needed to have been paying for itself at some point.
Yes, I was fortunate in that I did have a house that had been on the market, and I sold it not very wisely. I didn't do very well out of it, but it did give me a little bit of a lump sum.
Okay.
And so I was using that up and putting it into stock, but I was very aware of it. And it wasn't very much. It was about 150,000 Rand. So it was minimal.
You're probably kicking yourself now thinking what that house is worth or what you could sell it for now.
Yes.
But don't think like that.
No. Yes and no. I mean, it was a stepping stone to what I've got here. I mean, it's
seed in the ground.
Yeah,
what would
totally.
You have done without it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was my investment into something much bigger, which is even more than what a house really will be in the long term. Mm. So because this is a residual income that will just keep coming in, whereas a house is a once-off buy and a sell.
True.
I think I forgot your question.
So you could you
oh yes
that,
okay
you had a very small runway like
yes
it wasn't going to last for
so after. It was already in that first year that I realized I needed to start putting in creating a business plan and finding somebody to invest.
Okay.
And
was that when you brought in the first investor?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that.
So getting funding, because that's always the next question for entrepreneurs is, you know, getting funding. So what I love about what you did is a lot of people want to first get funding. And you already had a year-long business that was operating. You had clients. You were making trades, if not money. You were there was money coming
there
in,
was
money going out.
Flow.
There was capital flow. How did you pick your investor? How did you find an investor?
I was quite fortunate. He's in the industry, so I went to just go introduce my product, and he. And I mentioned in the first discussion that I was putting together the business plan, and he said, please offer it to me.
Okay.
So that was a real blessing. I didn't have to, there wasn't a major look.
Yeah.
Do
you regret now that you didn't shop around for more options?
No, definitely not.
So
he was amazing.
He was a good fit at that time. You were
absolutely
happy.
And he also came from a corporate structure, so in fact he used his staff to get RX to be a proper PTY Limited.
Okay.
I got my export license. I became VAT
registered.
And up until the point that he got involved, I was still operating out of one bank account, and there was no separation between RX and my personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be dangerous and messy, definitely.
Yeah, I also had that for splitting of everything.
And it's a real step up that. Mm. And I think it can happen even inside, where you can have two bank accounts where you end up paying yourself a little salary or an amount that you live off. But with this cash flow coming in and me just spending it, and I know there were a couple of things where I was not watching my pennies, that, you know, one doesn't see the difference where it, whether it's making a profit or not, and where you're actually losing, because there is this flow coming in, but your expenses and the business expenses are two, you know, very separate things. So no, he was, it was perfect. And even in fact, the fact that he wanted out and the two beautiful business partners that I have now, was also a blessing. Ah, there was another blessing.
So many blessings.
Yeah, quite. I really believe very strongly in intention. In fact, if anyone was to ask me how I've built RX, I would say I've built it on gratitude.
Oh. How is gratitude and intention related? You mentioned visualizing very early. Mm-hmm. You said you visualized its success, mm-hmm. and now you mentioned gratitude and intention. Now, these may sound like sort of airy-fairy concepts, but so many people that are successful, businessmen, businesswomen all over the world, mention these words. Mm. So, like, practically speaking, can you talk me through visualizing intention and gratitude? Like, what are they practically?
The intention was, I want an investor. I want someone to come in with money. I believe in my product. I believe in how it's going to grow. And just being absolutely having the conviction.
So did you know how much you wanted, the kind of investor you wanted, how much percentage you wanted to give away? Did you have those numbers in your head?
No.
Or was it just like, okay, I'm ready for investment?
Yes.
I'm open?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
And then the gratitude, gratitude's been part of my life for as far back as I can remember, just being really grateful. Even the beautiful little wooden Wendy house that I ended up finding when I first arrived, and I was on a sort of organic permaculture farm, and it was this tiny little spot, but this beautiful view of the mountain. Wow. And it was, you know, it was miniature, but it was a safe space. And I appreciated and had gratitude for this safe space that I was in. Mm. And as the growth happened, when I moved into a home, into a little cottage that had walls, and I had a toilet inside, and then I have to walk across the driveway to get to the loo in the rain in the winter, I really appreciated and was grateful for the growth that I now had. And in fact, when my first partner got involved, I then got into a salary, and as I mentioned earlier, it was the first salary that I'd got in 17 years, and it was like, wow, amazing, now I'm getting this constant amount of money that I know that I can budget on. Mm. So paying for school fees and paying for rent and so on.
So always being appreciative of growth and your journey and moving from bad to better. Mm. And then, so that's gratitude. And then intention, like always setting an intention of, this is what I want.
Mm. So when he came with, the first partner came with the exit letter, the intention was to find someone who would buy him out. And there was no if, but, maybe that I would find them. Yeah. I just knew that I networked up a storm. Yeah. It was quite phenomenal how many people I met in that period of time. Mm. And yet, what was interesting, I had booked a Vipassana. Do you know, it's a 10-day silent meditation.
Oh,
it's a 10-day silent retreat. And I'd booked that in the January. And I was actually in a process of due diligence and financials for a potential investor, but they ended up being more corporate than they'd kind of given on to initially. And it was while they were doing the financials that I went off to the retreat, and I was staying in a little cottage, and there were four women, and there was one of them, Pippa, who I thought I knew from childhood. She looked so familiar.
Yeah.
You know, we'd never met before. She was Cape Town and I was Joburg. And she told me about her husband and his brother, who were setting up a business to invest in small businesses. Mm. And they became my partners.
Wow.
That was a very beautiful way of meeting him. Mm. And the other company that were going to get involved strung me along for 5 months and eventually wanted 80% shares. And I was like, fortunately, I still had this, like, strong belief in the product, and I was like, no.
80%. What kind of investor takes an entrepreneur's passion and waters it down to the point where they're going to lose their focus and their fire and
become an employee?
Become an employee. I mean, and sucks the. I mean, that is not a partner that you can actually. No,
absolutely not. That's why they. Exactly. That's why I realized they were more corporate than the family business that they made out to be initially, because I don't think. So currently I am on a 50-50% shareholding.
Yeah.
And in fact, the first partner wanted 51% and wanted me to have 49%.
Yeah.
And I was, I mean, for me, that wasn't going to work, because I knew immediately then there was a disparity in energy and it's not balanced.
Yeah.
And an advisor, a lovely mentor that I met in that networking period, gave me beautiful advice that, you know, if you needed to use the 51%, so even if I had 51% and someone else had 49%, then you've lost the relationship anyways.
Exactly.
And a partnership is finding solutions and working through whatever it is you need to work through to find, you know, to find the common vision and to find a solution together, not to use your 1% power to step on or make a decision.
Yeah. So, and then visualization. So you spoke in the beginning about visualizing and that. Is it something that you practice a lot, or is it, because I've actually started now, I know all the successful entrepreneurs, and we're talking like mega successful, they have a very specific morning routine that I'm trying to get into. So I'm not yet at 4 o'clock in the morning, but I have started getting up earlier, and I do 20 minutes of exercise. I mean, eventually this is all going to become like an hour of exercise and an hour of meditation and visualization and prayer and planning the day. And do you do any of that?
I have stages of doing morning sessions, and then, but yeah, I'm not really good. I often pick up my computer as my morning just to get on top of the work that needs to be done. Yeah, not ideal, but I mean, after the meditation, I meditated for a while, and at the beginning of this year, I actually took my team on a breathing course.
Oh, nice.
So for 3 months, I was waking up every morning and doing my breathing, and then that fell by the wayside. there's a beautiful man, Michael Beckwith. He's in the States. He was actually part of that movie, The Secret. But I loved the one thing that he said is, we don't suffer from ADHD. We suffer from IDHD, intention deficit disorder. Which I think is really powerful, because we, and especially in this day and age, our attention gets grabbed by our phone, our computer, just like constantly we're reacting.
Yes. Yeah.
But we don't spend enough time in like deciding what it is that we want. And I think...
Yeah, it's so true. I know one of the hardest questions I asked myself when I was retrenched from the company I was working at, and when I had this opportunity to go on my own for the first time, I really battled with the question, what do I want? It was the hardest question I'd ever faced in my whole life. What do I want? So I find that now every morning when I wake up, what do I want? And then I intentionally state, this month, this is what I want. These are the number
Amazing.
Of sales that I want. This is the profit that I want.
Wow, awesome.
Because the other thing that I realized was I was setting these great goals of I want to be earning this much by December, but I hadn't actually done the homework to say, okay, if I want to earn this much, how many sales is that? Okay, how many quotes is that? Okay, and how many meetings is that? Okay, how many phone calls is that? And emails to get the
number of meetings,
to see
if it was realistic,
to get the quotes out, to get the sales out. You know what I mean? So, so I do think that intention is a beautiful thing. Visualization is a beautiful thing. And then you sit and you plan your day. Okay, how do I get to? What do I have to do today to help me achieve what I just visualized? What one or two things am I going to do today to get to what I just visualized?
I think that's one way. I tend to not do that way.
That is where we're trying to.
I think I've heard once the universe isn't interested in the how, or the how, the detail. You've just got to know what it is. I kind of hang on to the what. Yeah, I think it has just been this journey of knowing that this is my financial vehicle. I have a big reason, my son, and loving my product and being just excited to get it out into the world, and knowing that it is that I have the ability to do it, that I actually have the belief in myself, and coupled with this beautiful product, that it will happen. And
so your milestones were, okay, so year one, you brought on an investor, so you've gotten into a whole bunch of small retailers, and then you brought on an investor that stayed a year. How long did they stay?
Yeah.
And then you brought on your partner investors, the two brothers, and they've been with you now. And so, like, your milestones into, so then you got into Woolworths, and you got into Pick and Pay, and now you're going global. So, what's your next big idea, and what's your next big focus, and how are you going to achieve that?
Well, I think you've just made me realize that my spaces have been very parallel in the growth. So initially, I had a beautiful packing warehouse called Ukama, who are now next door to us. Mm-hmm. And they had a warehouse, and initially they packed the product, and then they left it. I had just two pallets of stock. And they would send, I would send in the orders, and they would put it together, and they would send it out and charge me a fee on the courier and the handling fee.
Okay.
And then after a year, they moved to a bigger warehouse. And so I envisioned a space in their warehouse that was my own, which is what happened. We were two flights up in a little windy spiral staircase that we had to carry stock up and down. It was probably, you know, just a small, probably about a garage size, maybe a little bit bigger. And then I could feel that, it wasn't after a year, it wasn't working out to carry salt up and down. And that at that point, or just before, my partners Ian and Garth got involved, and I knew that I needed a bigger space. I could feel the growth, and I knew that I needed a space to grow into, and I needed a ground floor.
Okay.
So we then got our first real warehouse, which was around the corner from where we are now. Mm-hmm. And there was 135 square meters, and we were in there for 4 years.
Wow.
And we were driving stock to Ukama, just a couple of hundred meters, but we had to put stock in and then drive it and what have you. And then Janine and I envisioned working together more strongly. I love her ethos and her values. She really supports the community and feeds a beautiful creche every day and does amazing work in the community. And we give back a percentage to the San Bushmen up in the Kalahari based on sales.
Oh, wow.
And we've also got a very strong community support. There's a little township project that makes our little cotton bags now.
Oh, nice.
And it's packed by Ukama, which is this micro enterprise packing house. And then we've now moved into this warehouse recently, only 3 weeks ago. And it's a 500 square meter warehouse.
Wow.
And I wasn't enjoying going into the previous one, and I realized when we moved in here that we were so cramped. Like, we had these little pathways between the stock and the product and the bags, and we had outgrown it. And this space now for me is so exciting, because you can't grow if you don't have a space to expand.
Yes, that's true.
So, and I know now we've got a lot of vertical space. We won't need to move here for at least 5 years, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
But I felt like I couldn't grow if there wasn't the space to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing for this has been perfect. In fact, our first very, very, very big order is going off to the UK to Sainsbury's today or tomorrow. This is it, and all the way down there.
It's going to fly off the shelf.
You're going to be part of that.
Yay!
So, and in fact, I mean, this now has come in 2 weeks after moving into the space. So the timing has been so beautiful, such beautiful flow.
The right thing, you meet the right person, the right thing just all, I don't know, just divinely happens.
And that happens together. From gratitude, I believe. I really believe just giving thanks all the time for all the little things. Then it just, the flow, it allows for flow.
But you're also working really hard.
I'm working very hard. I am. That helps too.
Have you ever been like absolutely terrified? Like, you lost track of your spending, and it looked like you were going to go under and lose it all.
Something
just went like horribly wrong. Well, when someone returned a huge batch, and
when the first partner wanted out was quite,
your big.
Whew, yeah, they're terrifying.
Yeah.
Thinking that I could have lost 2 years of hard work.
Yeah.
But not allowing myself to get trapped in that fear, rather just being very, very proactive in finding a solution. Yeah, and then my rep that went on his own and didn't pay like 40,000 or 50,000 rand.
Wow.
It was a lot. But besides that, I haven't had any major crises. No.
Just the small everyday.
Sainsbury's order. Have you seen those barcodes? Those aren't right. And the order was supposed to leave today, and suddenly I was away for the last 2 weeks in Germany. Got back yesterday, looked at the barcodes, realized this stock is going to get rejected at DC in the UK, and then just having to make it happen very quickly.
So you still can't let go and let the business run by itself?
No, not
yet. I mean, if you can sit and look at a barcode and know that a barcode's wrong, So are you looking at any point to how dependent is the business on you? Because I think also as entrepreneurs we become, you know, there's something called entrepreneur's disease where we don't want a business to succeed without us. So then there's this like actually slightly toxic, poisonous secret mindset that some entrepreneurs have, where they'll almost poison their businesses themselves. I've seen this happen where it can't succeed without me. And they, you know, because they always want to be the hero coming along and saving the day. So that's something I'm so aware of in myself. Like, am I empowering my team? You know, like how much of the business is dependent on me? So how much of the business is you, and how much can we pull you away and will the business still survive? Or is it all just like resting on you like that?
No. I mean, I've had an awesome, we had a big fight this morning. Shafik up in the office.
All is forgiven, not.
Who's been with me for 4 years, and they've also grown with the business.
Okay.
So, I mean, I can leave for 2 weeks and he pretty much handles, but it's training him to have the eye in the detail.
Okay.
So the detail is so important.
Yeah.
And
the stuff you've learned through doing it yourself for all this time. So the business is only 5 years old?
7, actually, from the very beginning.
Okay.
7 years, yeah.
7 years, and that's amazing that you've taken it so far. And so you're going to conquer the UK this year, and so that will be tick. And like, how are you going to get into other countries? What's next for you?
So I attend shows, international food shows. So I'm just constantly plugging away to any interest that comes my way.
Yeah.
Plus I've got agents who do represent the product internationally. So in fact, this month we go to Saudi Arabia, we go to South Korea, another shipment to Germany, and I've just got back from a show and Russia's interested in the Netherlands. So we've in fact, we've exported to 25 countries, but probably only half are repeat orders.
Okay.
The UK felt more manageable.
Yes. Same time zone, same culture.
Yes, exactly. And so I've targeted on the UK, and UK feels now it's solid and got a good foundation and base. I've got a very beautiful ex-South African who randomly sent me an email. Hi, I've discovered Oryx and I want to sell it and market in the UK. Sure, what's your number? So he's full-time on Oryx.
Yeah.
He wanted to be out of his industry. And now my focus is slowly shifting towards the US.
Okay.
So I'm just actually in the process of paperwork and FDA and making sure all my ducks are in a row. Mm. And we're going to send product to Amazon as an initial, and then try and work... This is where you'll come in again, in the social media, to get some hype and some talk and to just get it known in the US. And then we'll see how that grows. But if I can crack that market, then we'll be very happy.
I think we're going to call it a day there. We're going to wrap it because I don't want to take up any more of your time. I know you've got Sainsbury's orders to get out. Barcode to fix.
I'll be sitting here putting stickers on.
But I just wanted to thank you, Sam.
Oh,
you're
thank
amazing.
You.
And
you too.
I don't want it to sound patronizing. I'm so proud of you. You've done such an amazing job. I mean, to still be a single mom and have this huge baby, and this has grown to like a nice young teenager, or more like a preemie.
Quite right.
But there's still such an exciting journey ahead, and every day you're learning and problem solving and growing. And I think what I've learned as an entrepreneur is your business is as big as you are on the inside. So as you grow and face your challenges and overcome them. And
I think just to wrap up, the personal growth is so integral to growing a business. I mean, I've listened to hours of business audios and other or personal growth audios, and I've done a lot of work in that.
Okay.
That I don't believe I would have been able to achieve what I have to date without doing that work and putting in the time.
It's so interesting you say that, because I've joined this book club forcing me to read business books, which I never would have read myself. And I agree with you, learning the clever thoughts of clever, successful people, it just shortcuts things a lot.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, so there's a lot of information and beautiful mentors and people out there, and we've got access to the internet. We can, we can YouTube all sorts of people and ask questions.
So that's
a must.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's so true. Invest in yourself, not in watching TV series.
Oh, totally, no. Awesome.
Cool. I just want to thank you. Thank you guys for watching.
Thank you so much.
That's a wrap for episode 12. And stay in touch. And please go and buy some RX salt. Quickly plug your salt. Tell me why it's better than Himalayan.
Okay. Oh, I haven't even really told you about the salt. So it comes from a very beautiful salt pan, just short of 50 kilometers south of Botswana. 250 kilometers north of Upington. So there's a beautiful 50 square kilometer salt pan, and they discovered underground a 55 million ton salt lake.
Wow.
It's fed also by underground rivers, so it's renewable and sustainable. And the rivers flow through rock strata that have been geoscientifically tested at 300 million years old. So it really is an ancient pure source. And the whole area is uninhabitable, so there's no pollution, there's no contamination. And we pump up this brine, it's 100% saturated, so it crystallizes into pure white crystals in 4 weeks.
Wow.
We add no chemicals, and it's still got all the beautiful vital minerals and trace elements that salt is supposed to have. So it really is salt. A lot of products on the shelf now, they call it salt, but it's industrial salt, and it's had all the goodness stripped out, and they've added chemicals so it flows freely, but actually salt's not supposed to do that. It's supposed to absorb moisture, which allows our bodies to be hydrated. And our grinders have a ceramic mechanism, so they're 10 times refillable. So we try and make the products as renewable and sustainable as possible, because the source is.
It's not dynamited.
It's no. And we are 70% saline solution. Our tears, our blood, we need to replace with beautiful unrefined salt.
Clear.
And here we have from our beautiful Kalahari.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Go and buy some salt.